This is Only a Game. I'm Howard Bryant, in for Bill Littlefield. While researching my book, The Heritage, I was struck by the enormous effect the September 11th terrorist attacks have had on sports. How they look, how they're packaged, and how they're sold. Before 9/11, giant flags and flyovers were reserved for the Super Bowl. Today, they're commonplace. Even the players wear camouflage jerseys. The military is omnipresent, and it's by design. The public accepts this as supporting the troops, but one group of individuals, the veterans themselves, is more skeptical. One voice stood out, William Astorres.
You know, they bring out a humongous flag. You know, military jets fly overhead. Sometimes it's a B-2 stealth bomber. Sometimes it's fighter jets.
Bill Astorres is a retired Air Force lieutenant colonel who writes about the increased militarization of sports and its perils on Bracing Views, his personal blog, as well as the website Tom Dispatch.
I think at first there's a sort of thrilling feeling, right? I'm like all the other fans. You know, a big plane goes overhead. Wow, you know, that's kind of awe-inspiring. But at the same time, to me, it's not something that I see should be flying over a sports stadium before a baseball game or a football game. You know, these are weapons of death. They may be required, but they certainly shouldn't be celebrated and applauded.
Astorres grew up in Brockton, Massachusetts, the bare-knuckle town of famed boxers Rocky Marciano and Marvelous Marvin Hagler. He's an avid Red Sox fan, and when he watches sports, he sees the perpetual selling of war and something very cynical, patriotism for sale, with troops as bait. The All-Star Game in Washington this week was so awash in ceremony, it conjured thoughts of an old joke with a new twist. I went to a military parade, and a baseball game broke out.
I think our military has made a conscious decision. And that decision was, as much as possible, to work with strong forces within our society. I think our military made a choice to work with the sporting world and vice versa. I think that's something that is a response to 9/11.
Before 9/11, an American flag the size of a football field was unheard of.
What I remember from going to games is, you know, I remember the national anthem, a conventional-sized American flag, and that's all I remember.
National anthem, color guard, and on big games, you got bunting.
Right.
That's where, you know, you got bunting on the 4th of July, you got bunting at the World Series. That's
right. And I have to say that I thought, you know, that was enough. You know, after 9/11, there were so many people that I saw who broke out the flags and put them on their cars and had a spontaneous reaction to a feeling that we as Americans needed to come together. And that felt good.
In the years following 9/11, professional sports took a healing gesture and transformed it into a way to make money. In 2015, Republican Senators John McCain and Jeff Flake released the report Tackling Paid Patriotism, which criticized the deceptive taxpayer-funded contracts between the Pentagon and virtually every pro sports league. In 2012, the New York Army National Guard paid the Buffalo Bills $250,000 to conduct on-field reenlistment ceremonies. In 2014, the Georgia National Guard paid the Atlanta Falcons $114,000 to sing the national anthem. In 2015, the Air Force paid NASCAR $1.5 million, in part for veterans to shake hands with racing legend Richard Petty. Your tax dollars at work.
Yeah, I hate to say it, but I wasn't completely surprised, but I was disgusted by it. Patriotic displays, they mean a lot more to me when they're spontaneous. But to learn that these had been paid for, that corporate teams, you know, teams owned by billionaires basically, were collecting money from the military, paid for obviously by you and me, by the American taxpayer. Well, it was sad.
American flags are the ultimate good housekeeping seal, and thanking veterans for their service disconnects the public from what has been nearly two decades of war. The ballpark ceremony obscures the realities of war, and by focusing on soldiers, inoculates the government from anti-war criticism. Bill Astorres tells me it's a form of emotional manipulation.
Under the Bush-Cheney administration, we weren't even able to see the caskets of dead soldiers. The cost of war, that very ugly face of war, was being kept from us.
So we feel nothing
yeah.
as everything's being fought.
The only time we see it sometimes is when they bring out a wounded soldier, for example, and maybe he or she has lost two or three limbs, but they're brought out into an NFL stadium or an MLB baseball game. And the impression that you get is everything's okay, see? But we don't see this person struggling to get around at home and maybe being depressed because they've suffered this horrible wound in war.
Nick Francona grew up in baseball. His last name is a dead giveaway. His grandfather, Tito Francona, played 15 years in the big leagues and was teammates with Hank Aaron in the 1960s. His father, Terry, played 10 years in the majors and famously managed the 2004 Red Sox to their first World Series win in 86 years. Nick took a different path.
Yeah, I was in my freshman year at Penn. A friend of mine that I played travel baseball with, he had enlisted after high school and was an infantry marine, and he was in Iraq during my freshman year in college. And it used to keep me up at night, and it would bother me a lot where I would kind of sit there and be like, man, like I'm playing a lot of online poker, going to econ classes, and going out to bars, and we have like a war going on. I felt like I was missing out and like not contributing or doing my part.
Nick joined the Marines, becoming a scout sniper platoon commander in Afghanistan.
I remember my mom at one point wanted me to, she was like, well, you can pick any of the jobs. Why don't you be a comptroller or a finance type of officer? And I'm like, Mom, like nobody watches a Marine commercial and is like, oh, I really want to do the accounting for them.
Almost immediately, Nick felt the commercial effects of post-9/11 sports. In May 2010, even before he was deployed overseas, he was being sold as a hero. It felt inauthentic.
They were having Marine Week in Boston, and it was a pretty big deal. They had wanted me to throw out the first pitch at Fenway during one of the games. It would have been a good story of having the manager's son be a Marine and throwing out the first pitch at Fenway, but I was horribly uncomfortable with that and didn't think I had done anything to deserve that and gave them a firm pass on that one.
After he left the service, Nick worked in baseball for the Angels, the Dodgers, and the Mets. Ostensibly, he was a liaison to veterans, but what was being sold to the public as patriotism felt like commercialism. What Bill Astori wrote outside the game, Nick Francona felt working within it. Camo jerseys, corporate sponsorship of service. Without the authenticity of service, the veterans felt like props.
And I mean, if you look at kind of the tone of what Memorial Day has become about, it's pretty gross. Even on the team's official Twitter accounts, a flame emoji for like, look how like hot these camo hats are. And it's like, really, guys? Like, that's the plan? I mean, you can imagine how like some of these like Gold Star families reacted to that. They were not remotely amused. I might have asked a question 100 times and said, okay, if you're selling a $40 hat, how much of this is going to charity and where is it going? I think it's fair to say if you're an average fan watching Major League Baseball, you're going to be like, man, these guys like really are supportive of the military.
This support, Nick says, does not exist within MLB. According to the league's figures, only 10 of the league's 5,000 employees are veterans.
That's genuinely difficult to accomplish. Like, if your goal was to hire as few veterans as possible, that's pretty impressive. I'm almost certain that there's more than 10. But they've really gone out of their way to avoid being able to even identify, like, the veterans. I've been arguing for that for, like, 10 years to, like, figure out who they are so we can, like, support each other and, like, link up and try to address some of these issues, and they patently refused to be involved in that.
Working with the Mets, one moment defined his frustrations. He created a Memorial Day program where he matched players with Gold Star families from similar backgrounds. The players recorded videos that told the stories of the fallen.
Hi, I'm David Wright with the New York Mets. This Memorial Day, I am remembering Marine Corporal Christopher G. Scherer.
Players, he says, were emotional learning the stories of the dead soldiers from America's wars. They wore bracelets naming soldiers they were matched with. It was authentic and personal, appropriately respectful of a day commemorating sacrifice.
So I get an email, I'm on the flight back, and I get an email from someone with the Mets asking, they're like, okay, like, great job, now we need to get all the families to sign these waivers to like waive the rights as licensees for the bracelets that the guys wore. And I'm like, whoa, 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 we're not, like, absolutely not. they referred to them as license holders, the families. And I'm like, I think you mean as, like, parent of, like, dead Marine or soldier. Patently offensive. And there was, like, no way I was going to have them sign that and, like, refuse to do so. I wanted to know exactly whose bright idea this was and was going to give them a piece of my mind. And that ended it pretty quickly. And then the next day was my last day there. They called me in and said, you've done a great job here. Really had a huge impact. You've also had a big impact on the veteran stuff with Major League Baseball, but your comments aren't compatible with having a career in baseball. So we're going to have to part ways.
The Mets fired him. Nick Francona is now out of baseball.
I'm certainly not happy about not working in baseball. It was my dream job and was good at it. And the people that fired me ironically told me I was very good at it. It sucks. Even thinking about it, I wouldn't go back and say, I wish I just like compromised my principles a little more so I could succeed here. Like, if that's the price of success, like, I'll find something else. I think it's sad, and I think it speaks volumes about the state of Major League Baseball.
Recruiting is a main reason the military is embedded in sports. In an interview for my book, I told 3-star General Russell Honore I didn't want the Army recruiting my son while he watched the Red Sox. His response: you better hold on to him if you don't want them in the Army. We're going to recruit the hell out of them. That's how we man the force.
I appreciate the general's honesty. it's refreshing in a way. But I just think that's the wrong way to recruit.
That's Bill Astori again.
I was in Williamsport. I lived in Williamsport, Pennsylvania for 9 years.
Home of the Little League World Series,
that's
right?
The home, yes, of the Little League World Series. And 1 year, an Air Force van showed up. So kids, you know, Little Leaguers could come and go into this van and play video games. And the Air Force thought this was a great idea for recruitment. And I thought to myself, this is completely inappropriate. I mean, the Little League World Series should be for children. I mean, they're not even teenagers.
And for baseball.
And for baseball, yeah. It should not be an opportunity for any military service to show up and try to recruit youngsters. When I was interested in the military in high school, I went to see my civilian guidance counselor. There wasn't a Marine recruiter challenging me to a pull-up contest. And so I see these kinds of things as a gradual process of the militarization of our society. And I just see it as something that we as a democracy should be guarding against.
Where do sports go from here? I asked one baseball executive who told me his sport promotes the military not out of patriotism, but out of fear, the fear of being called unpatriotic. Nearly 20 years after 9/11, Bill Astori believes these rituals have served their purpose.
We sing God Bless America during the seventh inning stretch because, well, that's what we do now. We have a huge flag and military flyovers because that's what we do. We celebrate a military person after the fourth inning because that's what we do, and we've come to expect it. I think we as Americans need to come together and recognize that all of this needs to be ratcheted back, that we need to return to a simpler time when you played the national anthem, you respected our country, and then you play ball and you just enjoy the game the way it was meant to be enjoyed.
One day in 2013, writer Tom Coyne got the idea to play all 14 British Open golf courses.
Compared to sort of what I'd done in some of my other books, playing 14 courses was really quite reasonable.
But 14 turned into 111. That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
I'm Howard Bryant, in for Bill Littlefield. It's time for 3 stories you should know.
To all the moms out there, you know, I was playing free today, and I tried, but, you know, Angelique played really well. She played out of her mind.
That, of course, is Serena Williams speaking after the Wimbledon finals. And that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Lindsay Gibbs, sports writer for Think Progress. Welcome, Lindsay.
Thanks for having me.
And The Wall Street Journal's Rachel Bachman. Hi, Rachel.
Hello, Howard.
Lindsay, let's talk Serena.
Yeah, so 10 months after she nearly died giving birth to her daughter, Olympia, Serena made it all the way to the Wimbledon final last weekend, where she lost in straight sets to now three-time major champion Angelique Kerber. As you heard in the clip, Williams dedicated her run at Wimbledon to all the moms out there. She's been incredibly frank and open about pregnancy and motherhood, and it's really put maternity rights, both in tennis and in other sports, in sharp perspective. If you'll remember, she was unseeded for the French Open. That caused a lot of controversy. And now other tournaments are taking pregnancy and maternity leave into account when doing their seeding, which is a good step. However, throughout the sports world, and even in tennis, there's a really long way to go. In the WNBA, a player can get 50% of their contract when they leave for maternity leave, but that's only if they're under contract. There's no child care in any of these sports leagues. The LPGA actually just recently added child care. So there's so much work still to be done. Do you think that we'll get to a place where motherhood in sports is fully supported, and can Serena move the needle with all the advocacy work she's doing?
Serena's important for a number of reasons in this issue, mainly because women's tennis has been around so long. These younger leagues, the WNBA, the NWSL, I think a lot of these women are reluctant to ask for more benefits because they're worried about their league's viability. And so Serena really can help others by just modeling this behavior. Hey, things should change. Things should be better.
Yeah. And one of the things about this, too, is that we always say that the smartest person in the room is the one with the biggest number of zeros on their paycheck. Serena is the one. She's the one. And in women's tennis is where the female athletes are making the most money as well. When you have someone like Serena who can be out front on this issue, hopefully what it does is it allows the other athletes to feel like they can speak more freely. But once again, when you're talking about team sports, the gap between what Serena earns and Serena's power is so different from, say, a WNBA player.
I hope what it does is empower women to go to their unions and ask, okay, can we make this a top issue in our next bargaining sessions? Because that's really what it's going to take. They need to band together and bargain this.
Well, one of the areas that's really big is the fact that with individual athletes, especially on the women's side, when you do something unpopular, they can come after your money, they can come after your endorsements, they can do all that. But with a team sport, if those unions do get stronger, then you can actually see a little bit more power on the women's side. And that's exactly what we need. You know, speaking of tennis, the other story, in addition to Serena Wimbledon, was the epic. And epic is not always a compliment. Men's semifinal between John Isner and Kevin Anderson won, and this is tennis, not volleyball, 26-24. By Anderson. The match renewed calls for a fifth set tiebreak and deciding sets in all Grand Slam tournaments, a format that's only used in the U.S. Open. This, to me, is a John Isner problem. I like to think of myself as a reasonable person. But remember when Isner in 2010 battled 70-68 over Nicolas Mahut, which is a ridiculous score for a tennis match. Here's a suggestion, folks. Break serve. Just break serve. That's all we're asking. Since 2011, there have been 542 five-set matches at Wimbledon, the French Open and Australian Opens combined, and only 6.6% of them have gone past the 11-9 score in the fifth. So, Lindsay, Rachel Bachman, help me here. You're my only hope. Am I wrong here? Are we really willing to change the sport and change the rules of an entire sport? Really, just for one guy?
You know, I think we should, because it's not so much.
So you're going against me on this?
I'm going against you. I'm sorry.
Come on, man.
Because it's not so much about Isner. It's about saving the rest of tennis from Isner.
From Isner.
I mean, their match went so long.
6 hours and 37 minutes.
Yeah. That what it did is it messed up the schedule for the entire weekend. So the women's final the next day didn't have a start time, which is just so disrespectful to the women.
Completely.
And the women's double final didn't even get to be played on center court. So honestly, I know what you're saying, but I am for this because we kind of had to save tennis from John Isner right now.
Howard, I'm siding with you on this one. And here's why. There's a few sports that have these just like oddball rules or lack thereof. And I love the quirks of tennis. I think we should embrace them. I love that Wimbledon, for instance, has a curfew, 11 p.m. curfew. I just picture the queen like coming out onto her porch in Buckingham Palace and saying, that's quite enough. And, you know, and then just picking it up the next day. Like, I like those quirks, and I think we should embrace them.
Well, I think John Isner is the problem. But I also think, too, that Wimbledon may have to be the one. I don't think that the French or the Australian Open really need this. But Wimbledon might, because
playing on grass, you can essentially serve all night and the returner doesn't have a chance. However, Lindsay, you're 100% right that this was a completely disrespectful thing to the women. That was Saturday is supposed to be the women's day. It's women's championship day. I think they messed this up. I still don't think they need a tie break because I think they could have handled it differently. Yeah. But I really just do not want to see them change the entire sport just because John Isner can't return a tennis ball. I'm sorry on that. I can't help it. All right. Rachel Bachman, take us away. I am. I'm fired up about this. Rachel Bachman, take us away from tennis, please.
Well, it's curtains for the Final Four. That's $5 million curtains. U.S. Bank Stadium, which will host the 2019 Men's Final Four, is shelling out more than $5 million to cover about 460,000 square feet of windows and clear material in the stadium. This is because the NCAA wants this stadium to essentially feel more like an arena, indoors, darker, a little more intimate. But this phenomenon is really highlighting a broader trend in sports, which is these more open-air, light stadiums that are still enclosed, but you know have a lot of sunlight coming in. Houston, which also got a bid to a future Final Four energy stadium, has a giant translucent roof that they have to cover with about $800,000 worth of curtains. So what do you guys think of this trend toward the world's biggest curtains?
Well, Lindsay, you're going to be much kinder than I am, so please, please take it away. Go ahead.
I don't know that I am. For this one. I just hear these numbers, and I'm sorry, the only thing I can think is pay the players.
Pay the, like, play the players, right?
How are we doing this? How are we spending $5 million on curtains to play the
games? There's no money for the players,
Lindsay. And yet we're all claiming that, you know, there's just no way to pay the actual labor.
Here's what I think about this. I think, number one, I think the curtain part is actually funny. That part made me laugh, and the numbers on it kind of make me cry on it. But at the same time, as someone who watches basketball, who on earth would want a seat that's 3 miles from the court? This is such a huge money grab. Rachel, when you're at the Final Four, what do they do up in the cheap seats? Do they simply have big television monitors up there, or do you just get to tell everybody that you're at a game you can't see?
Well, since I get to sit in the cushy media seats, I don't really have to experience that. But I will tell you, you know, the NCAA requires that stadiums that host the men's Final Four have at least 60,000 seats. And this is basically like cramming three arenas into one space, right? But those things are full every year. And so as long as people are willing to pay the money and willing to get the nosebleeds, you know, I think the NCAA, which, by the way, makes about 85 to 90% of its annual income on the basketball tournament, you know, can justify this setup because people are still coming.
Well, I think for my second act, I'm going to be a tailor.
One of the firms working on the Minneapolis Stadium is hiring Howard, so take note.
All right, that is curtains on this edition of Three Stories You Should Know. My guests have been Lindsay Gibbs, sports writer for Think Progress. Thank you, Lindsay.
Thank you.
And Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal. Thank you.
Thank you, Howard.
The world's best golfers are at Carnoustie in Angus, Scotland this week for the British Open. Carnoustie and other courses in the British Open rotation inspired author Tom Coyne's most recent golf adventure. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
During the 2013 British Open, Tom Coyne got a text from a friend in Britain.
Hey, there are 14 open courses. We should go play them all.
Coyne's friend was pitching to the right person. Coyne had written a book about trying to qualify for the PGA Tour, and another about playing every seaside course in Ireland.
Compared to sort of what I'd done in some of my other books, playing 14 courses was really quite reasonable.
Coyne thought a quick spin around Scotland's many links courses might yield a good magazine article that would appeal to U.S. golfers. But what exactly are links?
Basically, when we say links, we're referring to dune land. You can go out and play it in the dunes because no one's using the dunes except for the sheep. And it also means that the course has kind of been sculpted by nature. You see all these crazy dunes and these moundings, and those were not put there by bulldozers. They weren't put there by shovels. They were put there by ice ages, by shifting continents. They were put there by miracles of nature. You have to engage the terrain. You can't just pretend it's not there and play over everything like we kind of do here. And if you're doing that, you got to use your imagination.
At his home outside Philadelphia, Coyne's imagination began to run wild. He bought a map of Scotland and a box of pins and began to plan the trip. He thought,
well, if I'm going to go play these 14, I should play this course and that course. So the list just grew and grew and grew, and the map got more crowded with these pins and finally arrived at a total of 107 destinations, which was obviously quite absurd.
It took Coyne nearly a year to arrange tea times and places to stay, and to coordinate flights, car rentals, and ferry schedules. It was a full-time job for the college professor, husband, and father of two. Coyne's final itinerary expanded to 111 rounds at links courses throughout Britain. He'd play all of them in just 57 days. The last would be a qualifier for the 2015 Open. If he made it, it would fulfill his dream of playing golf at the highest level. But Coyne wanted more than that.
I wanted it to be a very much a no stone unturned kind of search for the secret to golf, because I didn't want to leave and say, well, if I'd gone there, maybe I'd have met a person or found something or figured something out. Something would have happened in my game or my swing, and that would have unlocked golf for me.
Coyne arrived in England in late April of 2015. His first stop, a links course on England's southeast shore.
Ah, Littlestone. It was a great place to start. We got good links weather, wind and rain, and I believe I opened with a score of 80.
That's pretty good for you and me, but for a guy whose goal is to qualify for the Open?
You might as well have shot 1,000.
After playing 13 more rounds in England and 3 in Wales, Coyne arrived in Scotland. He golfed his way up the east coast to fabled St. Andrews, where he was joined by his wife Alison and their 2 children. He walked the famous Swilkin Bridge with them, and he played the old course with his 82-year-old father.
It was cold, and the wind was blowing things all over the place, blowing balls across the green. It was barely playable. And my dad smiled through the whole thing, which was amazing.
But there was one slight problem that threatened to ruin this idyllic scene.
On around the 16th hole, I noticed that there was something missing on my hand. And I realized my wedding ring is gone.
Coyne says he had lost a lot of weight walking 28 courses during the first 16 days of the trip. He thinks that, in the constant cold, had shrunk his ring finger by 2 sizes.
And Alison, you know, is in St. Andrews at that point. And I'm just spending, like, the next 3 holes trying to think, like, what am I going to say? What are we going to do? You know, this is a wife who's definitely given more than her share to the game of golf as her husband takes off for months at a time to do these ridiculous things. And here it is, I lose my wedding band on a golf course. Then this miracle occurs on the last hole. A caddy comes running from the distance, and he arrives to our group out of breath and says, did anyone lose a wedding ring? And I just thought, this is the greatest place in the world. My miracle, my St. Andrews miracle. You know, if I don't qualify for the Open, that's okay. I got my miracle.
There were other memorable, albeit slightly less miraculous, rounds at other less famous Scottish courses.
One that sticks out that I definitely kind of see in my dreams or my nightmares is the opening tee shot at a place called Machrahanish. The first tee shot there is right on the beach, and it's sort of on like a little rocky precipice. And what you hit out over is a public beach, and the fairway is on the other side of that beach. Now, what's on that beach are things like children, families, sandcastles, joggers. You know, there are people using the beach that's separating you from where you're trying to hit.
For the record, no one was injured by Coyne or his golfing partner that day. Coyne was nearing the end of his trip, and his golf, or more precisely, his links golf, was getting better.
I had to learn how to play in the wind. You have to read break into your putts depending on how the wind's blowing. So I definitely became a much more creative player. I feel like I have many more shots in my bag than I did before I went over there.
At the Open qualifier at Edinburgh's Brunsfield Links on June 22nd, Coyne applied all he had learned, but came up short. As he holed out, he tried to put his 57-day, 111-round experience into perspective.
It was a little bit confusing, to be honest, because I had been in this chase mode. I was chasing good golf. I was chasing the next round. I was chasing the next town. And to hole out and finish my final round and go from next to stop, it felt really bizarre. Because I just become so accustomed to the next shot and so accustomed to the next opportunity to do better. It was complicated.
Coyne's back in the States now. He's a professor of English at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia. This weekend, he'll be watching closely and a bit wistfully as the world's top golfers compete in the Open at Carnoustie. I asked him if he plans to make another trip similar to the one he made to Britain.
We had friends over the other night, and one of them slid me a map of New Zealand.
Coyne looked at his wife and waited for her reaction.
And she got all excited. So I said, you don't need to push me. Let's do it.
Could it be that Tom Coyne still hasn't discovered the secret of golf? He'd better keep looking for it.
That's Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Tom Coyne's new book is called A Course Called Scotland. On June 27, 1981, a dozen competitors gathered in Henniker, New Hampshire for the first recorded paintball game.
We had a guy who was the best turkey hunter in the state of Alabama. We had a wild elk hunter, a Green Beret lieutenant. We had a venture capitalist from New York. We had a surgeon. We had a movie producer.
That's just ahead on Only a Game. And you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Howard Bryant. Coming up next week, Only a Game celebrates 25 years of Bill Littlefield. But now it's time to talk this week's news with Charlie Pierce. Hi, you, Charlie.
Hey, Howard.
So let's start laughing before we go.
I can't believe this
so
guy.
So let's start with the piece of work that is Larry Fedora, the head football coach at the University of North Carolina. First, during media day in Charlotte, he questioned the validity of the brain injury studies of CTE, essentially saying that the conclusions are in the eye of the beholder. I don't think you agree with that, do you?
Well, no, it's the conclusions are in the double vision of the beholder. Actually, if you ask me, I think Larry Fedora should keep his opinions under his hat. Hey!
I see what you did right
it's
there.
It's summer!
Right.
Now, this guy needs to have a fire hose put on him. Because not only did he deny the undeniable evidence that football causes CTE and various other symptoms, he also went out of his way to say that football was under attack. And if football goes, the country will go down, too.
Did you call the National Guard this
week? How did the United States survive until somebody thought to pick up the soccer ball and run with it?
But there is something to this in terms of he's out of his mind, obviously. But when you think about where we are right now in football, with the flags, with the Flyers, well, he's talking about a narrative that we see playing out every single week, that somehow the military and football are inseparable.
Yeah, he's actually got his, you know, very clumsy thumb on two different issues. The second one being that football is in trouble. People don't want their kids playing it anymore. NFL players don't want their kids playing it anymore. It's freaking dangerous. Sooner or later, it's going to filter down even to those places where people are fanatics about high school football, and the game is going to have to change, and Larry Fedora probably won't recognize it when it does.
The owner of the Miami Dolphins, Stephen Ross, said he would suspend players who did not follow the NFL's new national anthem policy, perhaps by as many as four games, which is what you get for steroid use. And now the NFL just put out a statement saying that they're going to have discussions about the anthem policy. These guys can't quite get it right, can they?
They cannot get out of their own way on this issue, and they know they can't. They used to tell you if you watched, like, you know, Tarzan movies, if you fall in quicksand, don't struggle because it makes it worse. That's where the NFL is right now. They're in the quicksand, and they think they're in water, and they're trying to swim, and they're sinking like a stone. To me, the ultimate indication that this whole controversy is something the NFL will never be able to solve for itself was the notion that players could stay inside the locker room for the anthem, and then they believed that people wouldn't then say, it's un-American to stay inside the locker room during the anthem, which the president took about 11 minutes, I think,
less
to jump all over.
Let's also not forget that Ray Rice was caught on video clocking his wife.
Right.
On video, he got two games.
Right.
And now for kneeling for the national anthem, or kneeling during the national anthem, you could get four games?
Maybe they're worried that these guys are using, you know, performance-enhancing drugs to be able to kneel. you know, because their knees are all shot. I don't know.
Oh, by the way, Tom Brady also got 4 games for the inflation of a football.
Which may or may not have actually happened. Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about loyalty, or better yet, let's talk about power. The Toronto Raptors traded DeMar DeRozan, the same DeMar DeRozan who re-signed with the team last year because he loved the city, he wanted to be loyal to his team, he wanted to bring a championship to Toronto, and so they traded him to the San Antonio Spurs.
Yeah.
And DeRozan wrote on his Instagram page, "Can't trust him, ain't no loyalty in this game. Sell you out quick for a little bit of nothing."
Yeah, I mean, first of all, DeMar DeRozan is a terrific story. I mean, he comes as the phrase goes, straight out of Compton. He goes to Toronto and just absolutely falls in love with the place, puts both his arms around it. It does the same to him. And we both know that Toronto is just a terrific cosmopolitan
city
right now. And then gone, shuffled, goodbye, for Kawhi Leonard, who may well not play 40 games this year.
Who played 9 games last year, and I believe Kawhi...
And I believe is already complaining about having to go to Toronto. You know, I think DeMar DeRozan will be perfectly happy in San Antonio. It's also a nice city. But it's extraordinary that you would see a guy, you know, who literally decided to make himself a face of a franchise, which really hasn't had a face since Vince Carter, get treated like that.
Last but not least, Tuesday, Homer, the Peoria Chiefs mascot, a nice little floppy-eared dog, like I think he's a wiener dog. He was suspended for firing a squirt gun at an umpire the night before. But in an act of solidarity that would make Norma Ray proud, I think, the other mascots protested, picketing in front of Dover Park. One mascot, an ear of corn, held up a sign that read, "No Homer, no corn."
First of all, you and I have been to enough minor league baseball to be very suspicious about this whole thing.
No Homer, no corn.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if the Peoria Chiefs were slipping Homer a little, a little mustard under the door for having squirted that thing and gotten them national publicity for the mascot strike.
What I love about this is, one, you got the solidarity, because we're talking about the players and Colin Kaepernick and how come they didn't stand behind Kaepernick, but you mess with those mascots. You mess with one, you mess with all of us.
That's right. And there's nothing more ferocious than a classics major making minimum wage wearing a big, fat dog head.
You know what? That's what we call a mic drop right
Absolutely.
There. Absolutely. You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time, and he joins Bill Littlefield each week on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Howard.
Sports origin stories are often tricky. Dr. James Naismith definitely did invent the game of basketball when he nailed 2 peach baskets to a wall in Springfield, Massachusetts in December of 1891. Abner Doubleday definitely did not invent baseball in Cooperstown, New York during the summer of 1839. But what about the sport of paintball? Taylor Quimby recently tracked down that story.
This story starts with 2 men. 2 dueling philosophies and an argument.
Charles is sort of a workout freak.
He's just one of the most competitive people I've ever known. He's a jock.
On one side of the argument was author, bodybuilder, and all-around outdoorsman Charles Gaines.
I love to fish and hunt and canoe.
He's got a rugged Robert Redford look and is best known as the author of Pumping Iron. That's the book and subsequent documentary that made Arnold Schwarzenegger a household name.
The greatest feeling you can get in a gym, or the most satisfying feeling you can get in the gym, is the pump.
On the other side was Hayes Knoll, a New York stockbroker and former college football star.
76 years old, born in 1941.
Charles and Hayes were best friends and constant rivals. They played tennis, fished, and skied. A friend said that the pair of them could bet over the length of a dog or the number of bricks in a fireplace.
You have to do everything possible to win, you know, no matter what.
One summer in the late 70s, they rented a house in Martha's Vineyard with their wives. And one night, while grilling bluefish and downing gin and tonics, they picked up on a long-standing argument about the nature of survival. It was a third drink debate that had been raging for some time now, and it had to do with who would be better suited to survive in the wilderness, in a predator-prey situation. Hayes thought his experiences in the high-stakes arena of the New York Stock Exchange made him an ideal survivor. 102 minutes, 108, hold! He thrived on adrenaline and was unafraid to take risks.
I can survive in any jungle. So I can survive in the Wall Street jungle, I can survive in any jungle.
Charles believed just the opposite. that outdoor survival relies on a set of learned skills and abilities.
There's a great song by Hank Williams Jr. called A Country Boy Will Survive. We know about rifles and shadows and how to find moss on a tree and how to make a fire when you don't have any matches. It's just the idea that you could take city skills and transfer them into that sort of environment is typical of the kind of hubris that a lot of my city friends have.
The two drank and argued into the night, but there was never any way to take it further than words. That was until a few weeks later when a friend sent Charles a forestry catalog, one featuring a unique piece of equipment.
It was a single-shot CO2 cartridge-powered gun, a pistol, that shot paint-based pellets.
It was the Nelspot 007, the world's first paintball gun. It had actually been invented more than a decade earlier for use by foresters to mark trees on difficult terrain and farmers to mark bred livestock. It was the summer of 1979 or 1980. Charles was living in New Hampshire at the time, writing and teaching at New England College in Hanover. He ordered a couple of pistols, then invited Hayes up to see his new toys.
And I said, we're going to settle this one way or another. You say you can survive in the woods in New Hampshire as well as I can. We'll see about that, big boy. Come on up here.
Charles had a little field. It was all brushy. I said, why don't we go out and hunt each other in this field?
I knew where he was almost the whole time from the get-go. And I came up behind him. He was sitting down, getting his breath behind a tree. And I didn't have the heart to shoot him, so I just put the gun up to his head and said, okay, who wins, right?
Now, this is what you'd expect in a parable, right? The prideful and obviously wrong city slicker loses out to the woodsy folklore of the country boy. But this is an allegory. The lesson has to be repeated if you want it to stick. In the mind of Hayes, the stockbroker, nothing was really settled. There hadn't been any rules. Charles was playing on his own property. It ought to be best 3 out of 5. You get the idea. By this time, a third friend had joined the debate, a local ski shop manager named Bob Guernsey.
Guernsey is another tremendously competitive man.
And over the next few months, the three of them started to plan a grand experiment, a 12-person game that combined paintball guns and capture the flag and would span 100 acres of New Hampshire forest. They called it the survival game. They arranged for referees and staked out a property in Henniker, New Hampshire. And on June 27th, 1981, a dozen competitors showed up, decked out in camouflage, ready to play.
We had a guy who was the best turkey hunter in the state of Alabama. We had a wild elk hunter, Green Beret lieutenant. We had a venture capitalist from New York. We had a surgeon. We had a movie producer.
Joe Drinan was there. Back then, he was a stockbroker and amateur boxer.
It was friendly competition, but believe me, it was fierce competition. I mean, except for me.
Drinan's wife, Ann, was there that weekend, too.
I looked at this equipment and I thought, I don't believe this. It's like a bunch of 5-year-olds going out in the woods and just having fun.
Sports Illustrated staffer Bob Jones was there, too, with a photographer for the magazine who was looking to shoot pictures rather than contestants. Along with the invitations, Charles and company had sent along 8 pages of rules. The players would be spread out across the perimeter of some 100 acres of land. Each would be equipped with a pair of goggles,
one of the Nelspot pistols,
a few handfuls of pellets,
I think it was 12 or maybe 20 pellets,
a compass,
and a map.
Inside the forest would be 4 flag stations, each with 12 colored flags hanging from a branch.
White, green, blue, and red. And the point was to get one of each of the flags from each of the flag stations and be the first one out at the exit point, which was also marked on the map.
Players, of course, could eliminate each other at any point using the pistols, but
to be shot, to be officially put out of the game, you had to have paint on your clothes.
At 10 a.m., referees placed the contestants around the edge of the forest, out of sight from one another. And at the sound of a bullhorn, the game began.
You have to do everything possible to win, you know, no matter what.
It became every little twig that snapped, or every little bird, everything, every breeze, every branch that blew, was maybe somebody going, and it was just what kept the thing so exciting.
Hayes planned to outrun his opponents and started sprinting from station to station, collecting flags.
My strategy was, I thought, a great strategy. I was in great shape.
Meanwhile, Richie White, a licensed forester, he took the tried and true still hunting approach that he used when stalking deer.
Doing that, you hear someone else before they hear you, unless it's another person doing the same process.
Every little twig that snapped.
How people played the game reflected who they were.
Charles got two flags before facing off against the Green Beret, who took shelter in an old abandoned shack he found on the property.
We were shooting each other. I was shooting at him through the window. He was shooting me out the window. I was trying to circle around behind. And all of a sudden, I see this thing coming through the air, and it lands right at my feet and hits a potato. And Tony says, "Grenade!"
The potato was a joke, and eventually the two walked away in a truce. Both of them got tagged not long after.
So that was my Waterloo.
Hayes got three flags before being shot by a trauma surgeon who took out nearly half of the players single-handedly. And meanwhile, Richie, the certified forester, quietly made his way through the woods.
Ghosted through the whole field, picked up all four flags.
I don't think he even fired anything the whole game.
I can't say that Richie White didn't take risks. He just avoided confrontation.
Do you remember when you got out with the flags? Did you know what had happened?
No. Because it was over 2 hours, you know, I just said, well, who's ahead? I mean, who won? And they said, well, no one else is out.
It was the first recorded game of paintball ever played, but it was also the end of the debate between Charles and Hayes. The country boys had won.
Clearly, the woods skills were the prevailing skills, you know, in the game.
For a storyteller, this tale is about as good as it gets. There's an almost mythical quality to the survival story, the argument, the characters. But for a journalist, well, let's just say there are problems. That first game of paintball wasn't just a good time, it was also a convenient bit of public relations. Not long after, Charles Hayes and their friend Bob Guernsey started a business, the National Survival Game.
Survival Game, an adult version of Capture the Flag. Two equal teams that begin at opposite ends of a playing field.
As I spoke with people who were there and read firsthand accounts of the game written back in the 80s, a lot of little discrepancies started to pop up. After first getting the guns, Charles told me that he snuck up on Hayes.
It was a pretty simple, straightforward test, which I won.
But Hayes told me he snuck up on Charles.
I just crept up while I was right behind him.
And there are dozens of little problems about who did what, who first found the guns, who first bought the guns, where the argument started. And combing through all these different versions, you can see how the story was distilled, adapted for each new telling.
The truth is, my version is a true version.
If there are any irreconcilable differences in his story and mine, call me back.
In the end, maybe it doesn't matter. A good story is a good story.
That's reporter Taylor Quimby. You can hear even more about that first paintball game and its aftermath on the New Hampshire Public Radio podcast, Outside In. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach, with help from Matthew Stock. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our senior producer is Karen Given. Have you subscribed to Only a Game yet? It's the best way to make sure you never miss an episode. Go to iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Howard Bryant. Bill Littlefield will return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thank you for listening.